Both Pastor Matt and I were both very cryptic. We were hoping people would show up without any idea what in the world we were going to be talking about. This is the introduction of what this lesson is going to be. I called it Jesus BC. Jesus BC. And that's all the ways that we can try to find Jesus before he was born. So before Christ was born, what do we see about Jesus in the Old Testament? So I don't know. Is that me? That must be me. Am I just hitting it with my... I think turn it down, but make sure all the other mics are off because something's popping. And the only one listening to this is going to be Pastor Dan, so you could just make it so it doesn't come through the speakers. That would work too. Then he'll just have to deal with the loud noises. So when I was in college, I'm good. When I was in college, one of my favorite things was when they'd offer the opportunity for a summer class, the summer semester, because, you know, you'd go a semester in college, it's 15 weeks long, and they would say, look, we're going to do that in 3 weeks. We're going to do it in 3 weeks, what would normally be 15 weeks. And I'm like, this is going to be great. This is going to be awesome, because we're going to get through so much stuff that I would have said, oh, we're just sitting through boring lectures and all those things. And so I was so excited to sign up for my first summer class, and I have never been more wiped out after doing something like that. When I took a class, and I'm trying to remember what the topic was, it was something about patent protection and copyright law or something like that, something that no one would ever think to do on their own. And it was 3 hours of lecture every night, plus we were having to read like over 100 pages when we'd get home that night. It was meant to be that we were spending a total of 8 hours a day on this thing for 3 weeks. And that's not too bad if you have 8 hours a day to do that. But I was working full-time at the time, and I took a few vacation days, a few sick days too, because just like this just needs to get done. When I was done with it, it felt like quite an accomplishment. And that's what I'm hoping that we'll feel like a little bit tonight. Well, that's right. Pens will be helpful for this if anyone doesn't have a pen. I'm hoping that when we are done with this series, that we'll feel like that we have some sort of sense of accomplishment about trying to see what we can do about plowing through the entire Old Testament in 6 sessions. So I've already wasted a good amount of our time to be able to do this. But when we were coming up with the topic to be able to talk, I was talking with Pastor Dan, and we were talking about what could we do, and he knows that one of my weakest things that I have is prophecy and symbolism and things like that. He knows that that is one of my challenges, and so he said, why don't you do it about like prophecy and symbolism in the Old Testament? And so I appreciate him helping me in my spiritual walk and my spiritual journey. One of the things that I struggle with and why this is always a challenge for me is there's a big word called hermeneutics. Hermeneutics is how do you approach the Bible? How do you study the Bible? What methodology do you use to determine what is this passage saying to me? And one of the rules of hermeneutics is by default, you got to make sure that what you're saying the passage means is what the original author saw the passage meant and how the original audience would have understood it to mean. And so that's a really good rule. And that's a rule that should be always running through the back of our mind as we listen to things, whether if we're listening to things online or hearing other things or reading articles, we should always be cognizant of, does this make sense? Does it match up with what the original authors would have intended? Does it make sense with what the original audience may have understood it to mean? But there is a general exception to that, and that is when the Bible itself, in another place, tells you this is what that meant. Moses might not have known what that meant Let me tell you what it meant. So if we have an apostle, we have somebody in the New Testament, we have somebody that is helping us to interpret these things, that's a good place to say, you know what? The knowledge that's available in the Bible can exceed what the authors even understood and probably that the audience understood. And this is why I've always struggled with these types of things, and this is why Dan assigned it to me. So, when we think about prophecy, when we think about things that where the Bible tells us, gives us hints and an understanding of something that's going to happen in the future, the more I think about that, the more difficult I think that would be for God. Now, God can do absolutely anything, but as he's trying to organize this thing, one of the things that's really difficult about prophesying something is that you have to accurately know what is going to happen. You have to introduce that information earlier than when it happened, and you got to make sure that you don't cause that thing that was going to happen in the future to not happen. I don't know if any of you are fans of the movie The Matrix, and I'm not necessarily recommending it, but there was a, in this story, there's this woman called the Oracle, and she's supposed to be able to prophesy just about anything, and the main character, Neo, is walking through an apartment, and she says, "Oh, don't worry about the vase," and he goes, "What?" And he knocks into the vase that's right on next to him and crashes to the floor. And he goes, "Oh, I'm so sorry." And she goes, "No, don't worry about it." And she goes, "Now the question that you need to ask yourself is..." I don't know what that is, guys. What's that? Yeah, it's unplugged. But anyway, I'll keep this up here so I'm not bumping around so much. She says, "The question you got to ask yourself is, would you have knocked it over if I hadn't mentioned that it was going to break?" And that kind of got Neo in a bit of a tizzy. But it comes down to the problem of prophecy is that it's hard to make prophecy not change the outcome, right? When you're doing something, this is all everything to do with the science of time and all of this stuff is to say, you know what? If I introduce information in the past, it's very hard to not make that information invalidate or change what's going to happen in the future. So anyway, when I think about prophecy, I think it's very challenging. And I think the way that God does this, and I think that it's beautiful the way that God sets this up, is that prophecy is very hard to do, to look at, to come up with a good prediction of the future. But when you're standing in the future and you're looking back on the past, you say, "Whoa, that is amazing, the way that that lined up." That is what is so incredible about the way that God does prophecy. If he was too specific, then people could try to thwart that plan and make sure it never happened or whatever it is. But he puts so many details into the past that when you look back at a lens, looking back at those writings from the past, and you can see all those things lining up, that is what just validates the present. It validates what's happening right now. And in this case, it validates the life of Christ. Even if people couldn't necessarily look forward and see that exact event and understand exactly what was going to happen, when people turned and looked back from the actual life of Christ, they could see that this definitely was God himself. This was what God had been setting up from the very beginning of time. So, I think that about all prophecy. Our attempts to understand prophecy right now also have that same problem of looking forward. But I do know that when we look back, we'll say, "Oh yeah, I get it. And it probably was nothing like what I thought." But it lines up perfectly with what God has established. So let me just talk quickly about the format that we're going to go through here. And you can kind of see it on your page a little bit too. Each of these nights, I'm going to try to go through a section of the Old Testament, and my attempt is to try to see if we can do it somewhat chronologically. And so this first night, you're saying, "Dave, you gave yourself a real softball. You gave yourself 2 out of 39. We got to do 39 books. We're going to try to cover 2 of them tonight. But you'll see that we've got that Genesis covers a real lot, so we're going to try to do that. So tonight, we're going to try to cover Genesis. My plan is, if this works out, and it kind of depends on our overall mutual performance of whether or not this is working and how much feedback I get afterwards, whether or not this worked. But then the second night, I want to try to do stuff around the time of Moses. And then the third night, try to talk about they got into the promised land and the time of the judges. And then the next night, the fourth night, will be kind of a lot of scripture because it's going to be covering the reign of the kings, that was so Saul and David and Solomon, trying to cover that. And then the last night, I'm going to try to go back and reinsert the things from fifth and sixth night, try to reinsert things from the prophets, from the major prophets on one night and the minor prophets on another night. So this is my goal. We're going to see if we can get through all of it. And what I'm trying to come up with is at least one reference to Christ from all 39 books, and a lot of them will have more than one reference, but we'll be attempting to do that. As we go through it, just want to, I think you probably know that as I like to get up and speak, one of the things I like to do is to hit us with context, just try to hit us with the history, try to have us understand the narrative. I don't know how many of you were here back right at the beginning. It was a Sunday school series that was right at the beginning of COVID. Evan was a big part of it. I did a couple of them. I think there might be a few other people in the room. I don't know if Dave, if you did one or not, but we were trying to go through books of the Bible one at a time and try to hit some of the high points of those books of the Bible, and it was a lot of fun, and we were getting into it. I mean, I thought that everyone was really enjoying it. Then all of a sudden, COVID hit, and it was done, and we only made it like, I don't know, four, five, six books in, and I know there's a couple of us who were ready to go. We wanted to keep on going down that path, so I'm kind of hoping that this ends up being a high-level summary of some of that as well. And then, so those are the passages we want to do. And then what I want is, I want to go through myself and see if I can come up with the 10 to 15 most compelling references to Jesus that we have in the passages that we're going to cover that night. And that's what I've got on our page here. If you look down the left-hand side, you see Old Testament references, and that's what I kind of want to go to. Somebody's playing tennis with this system here. I want to go to this Old Testament reference. I would like to have one of us read that. Then I'd like us to answer the question amongst ourselves. How does this point to Jesus? How does this verse point to Jesus? And then we have some New Testament references for some of those as well to see if we can just look at how those compare to what is said about Jesus in the New Testament. So at the very, very top of the sheet, this is also what I'm going to try to do, is just give us a picture of where in time are we talking about. And this is why Genesis deserves to be a little bit on its own. So creation is somewhere around 4,000 BC. Then we've got Jesus somewhere around 1 AD. And so we've got about 4,000 years of coverage for the Old Testament here. Genesis covers more than half. More than half of the Old Testament timeline is covered by Genesis. And if you just look, the significant things that I stuck here were a little bit before 2000, and a lot kind of happens right around 2000 BC. Around 2000, there is the flood. A little bit before 2000 BC is the flood. It surprised me as I was going through this timeline, the Tower of Babel happens very shortly after there. This is like, okay, we got like eight people, right? And now we've got, within a couple hundred years, we've got civilizations that are trying to see if they can work their way to heaven, work their way to God. As soon as that happens, people start spreading out and doing their own thing, and not too much longer, according to just the archaeological information, we've got pyramids being built, we've got Stonehenge being built. The people are spreading out. This idea of that Babel is happening, people are spreading out and they're starting to do their own things, different areas of the world. And by 2000 BC, we've got Abraham coming on the scene, And then a little after that, we have Joseph. just a few generations later, we have Joseph. And that brings us to the end of Genesis. At the end of Genesis, we'll be seeing that we have entered into Egypt. We've come to Egypt, and so that's where this is going to happen. Is that God's promised people, which is now just a family, has found themselves in Egypt, and that's where we're going to pick up the story next week. Is that they have been in Egypt a little while when we get into Exodus. so again, let's just recap what's happening in the first 11 chapters of Genesis. We start with creation, and then within days, we've got Adam. Within days, or however long this happens, we have the fall happening very shortly thereafter. And then we have a big stretch of time where there is a lot going on, but the narrative here is moving at a very fast clip. As we're covering a lot of ground in a short while in the beginning of Genesis. A little bit later is where we talk about Noah's flood. And that kind of brings us to most of Genesis 1 through 11, which is the first chunk that we want to cover. Could I get volunteers on the first five Old Testament references? Can I volunteer for the first one, Genesis 1, Dave? Genesis 3, 5, Ethan. Genesis 3, 21, Evan. Genesis 4, 4. Yeah, you got it, Seth. And Genesis 6, 14. Yeah, go for it. And so let's get there and let's read. And I want everyone to try to listen to this because I want us all to try to be ready to answer the question, how does this point us to Jesus? Genesis 1, 26 to 27. Right. So I'll give you a hint. The idea is that he says that we've made man in our own image. What do we see there? What points us to Jesus in these passages? Anyone have any idea? Yeah. In our own image. Yeah.
In our likeness
as well. Right. Right. The Trinity exists at this point in time, so Jesus is there. Jesus is there at that time. It also talks about the fact that Jesus has that image of God the Father as well. They have something in common when he says, in our image. This image is something that is shared. I kind of forgot that I need to do the New Testament references too. Can somebody volunteer to do Colossians 1, 14 and 15? Yeah, Rebecca. When you get there.
Colossians
1, 14 to 15.
In whom we have redemption through his blood, even the forgiveness of sins, the supremacy of Christ, who is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of every creation.
So in that passage right there, it tells us that Christ is in the image of God as well, and that he was the firstborn. He is there at the beginning of creation. That's great. Anything else to say on that verse before we move on? We're going to keep on moving. I'm going to hand out these other three references. Could somebody do Hebrews 9:22 when we need it, Nikki? John 1:29, Dave? And 1 Peter 3:20-21. I'll give it to Bruce. Yes, excellent. Okay, so let's. Yes, Genesis 3:15. Genesis 3:15. Who's got that one? Ethan.
And I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed, it shall bruise thy head, and thou
kind of a famous verse. Anyone have any comment on how this shows us Jesus, how this points to Jesus? Yeah, Dave.
Conquering Savior.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything else to say about this passage? Yeah.
Just that he was necessary.
Yeah. 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 And this is a huge verse, a lot packed into this. Genesis 3:15 is, I mean, and it's kind of like, this is why the story has to start here, is because this is going to be the story, right? There's going to be this major conflict between Satan. Satan is going to try to be to try to work against God, and Satan is going to get his small victories, but ultimately he will be utterly defeated. And to be able to see that within the first three chapters of Genesis, I always just kind of imagine that imagine what's going through Satan's mind as he's trying to understand what his strategy is. Normally, he's got 4,000 years between now and when he's going to be able to think that he's getting some level of defeat here when he sees Christ die on the cross. He's got 4,000 years, but right at the beginning of that 4,000 years, it's right there. This is not going to end well. This is not going to end well for you. And he's still trying. He's doing everything that he can. But we know right from the very, very beginning that Satan will be defeated. So, yes, I have in my notes that Jesus will defeat Satan. Let's move on to Genesis 3:21. Genesis 3:21. Yeah. Out of batteries.
All right. And unto Adam also and his wife did the Lord make coats of skins and clothe them.
Okay. Any ideas how that might... So they needed coats of skin to clothe them. Yeah, go ahead.
It shows sacrifice.
Yeah, sacrifice is necessary to cover sin. Anything else that we can hear there? No, I think that's the main thing, is that we see right away... As soon as the first sin happens, there has to be a sacrifice. And in this case, it wasn't just sewing together some leaves. It had to be that we had to have an animal be sacrificed for their sin.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So who's got Hebrews 9:22? Nikki. So we can see that there, that the New Testament tells us too that blood was necessary, and it's pictured here in Genesis 3 at the same time. Who's got Genesis 4:4? Yep.
And Abel, he also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of the fat thereof. And the Lord had respect unto Abel.
This is going to be pretty similar to the last one, but what can we glean about Jesus from that Abel's sacrifice? Yeah, Josh.
Sacrifice of the lamb.
Yeah, there had to be a sacrifice. That was the only thing that was going to be pleasing to God. There's other things that we could try to do to try to appease God, but when it came down to it, that blood sacrifice was the only thing that was going to do it. And who's got John 1:9? And Dave Bird, did you have something to comment? No. Oh, okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I guess both Daves are raising their hand. If we could, we'll all just read in unison all the Daves at once. Sorry. Thank you for volunteering. Let's see. And let's move on to Genesis 6:14. Genesis 6:14.
Shalt thou make them an ark, and shalt pitch it within and without with pitch.
Okay, it's a hard one, guys. What is this telling us about Jesus? This is just talking about some of the instructions of how to make the ark. What does the ark tell us about Jesus? How does it foreshadow Jesus? The salvation, yeah.
So it's a type of Christ.
A type of Christ, because it was a vehicle of salvation for them. Yeah. Anything else about the ark that we can learn about Jesus? Yeah, go ahead.
Maybe that God is particular. He maybe delights in the details.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't leave it generic for us to fill in the details.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that there was a very specific thing that needed to be done, and that there could be other people trying to do things their own way or whatever, but God just makes it very clear. He makes it clear, and then he demands that we follow his instructions as well. Yeah. Who's got 1 Peter 3:20-21?
Which sometime were disobedient, when once the long-suffering God waited in the days of Noah, while the ark was a preparing, wherein few, that is, eight souls were saved by water. The like figure whereunto even baptism doth also now save us from the, not from the putting away of the filth of the flesh, but the answer of a good conscience towards God by the resurrection of Jesus Christ.
So the New Testament tells us very clearly too, this isn't just us making stuff up about the fact that that Noah's Ark was a picture of the salvation that Jesus has for us. We see that explained also by Peter when he's telling it in his letter as well. So I think those are all great ways that we can see even in early Genesis we can see those pictures of Jesus starting to form. Now, some of you are probably wondering, Dave, why did you switch over to Job? Job is like way out there, isn't it? Like way into the Old Testament. Didn't that happen a lot later? But the thing is the way that, just being clear, the way that the Old Testament is written is not chronologically set in order there. So all of Genesis is written by Moses. Moses doesn't write any of this down until about 1500 BC. So that's even after all of these events have happened. And this was meant to be a book of history and also a book of the law. Genesis was meant to be this. And then a bunch of other books are all books of history all the way through 2 Chronicles. It was all historical books. And then we get lots of extra books that tell us a lot of different types of writing, different types of things that all are inserted back into the narrative from before. Job is one of those, and probably the most glaring. Job is sitting way out there near Psalms, right? So about halfway through your Bible, you'll find Job. And it's theorized, because people don't know the exact date of when that would be, but it was theorized, but it would be somewhere around this Genesis 11 post-flood, probably before Abraham, but somewhere in that range. It's in a different area, but it would be after the flood, and so it would be some relative of Noah, but we just don't know exactly where this would be, but probably after Babel, probably has spread out a little bit too. And so, again, we don't know the exactness of that story, but tradition would tell us that it's somewhere in this range. And so that's why I'm sticking it in here to get some context. The book of Job is, again, since it's not one of our books that are meant to just be a direct history, the book of Job is an interesting book. We spend a lot of our time thinking about the first chapter of Job because interesting. It's an interesting story, right? And so in the first chapter of Job, we hear about this discussion between God and Satan, and there's a there's allowed to be affliction on Job, and all these terrible things happen, and all these things are going on in his life. And then the rest of the book is Job, his wife, his friends, all these people who have no vision, have no idea what that first chapter was. That first chapter was just for us, so that we could have a sense of what was actually happening there. The rest of the book is they go, I bet I know. I bet I know what happened. This is what happened, and that's why you're being afflicted. We figured it out. And so it's got all of man's philosophies trying to figure out what could have happened that would have made this situation happen. And we know, as the readers of the book, we can see the first chapter and we can say, boy, those guys, they don't know what they're talking about. And it helps us understand just how futile some of their reasoning was, right? Because we get a chance to see the beginning of the book. We get to look at it and we get to say, those guys are so far off, they're so way off, but they didn't know that. They didn't know the first chapter of Job. They're sitting there as trying to be good friends, trying to be good philosophers, trying to understand their moral obligation in this world, and they come up with all these arguments, and when it comes down to it, at the end of Job, is that God says, I'm sorry, you guys, you just have no idea. You're going to have to trust me. You're just going to have to trust me. And it doesn't mean that everything is going to work out, and it doesn't mean you're ever going to get all the answers. We don't know. You might never know. Just like I think that, at least the way the story is told, Job and his friends, at least by the end of the book, didn't know what had happened. So you might never know the answers, but you're just going to have to trust me through the difficult times, through the bad times, through the suffering. You're going to have to trust me. And so that's kind of the point of Job, even though we like looking at that first part of it, because just like, oh, I can figure out how Satan and God talk to each other, and I can figure out about what power Satan has and what he doesn't have. And there's all kinds of interesting things that we can try to glean from it, but we're just looking at the first little bit of the book, and the most of the book is talking about man's philosophies and how they don't really hold up to what the reality is in understanding God. So anyway, that's my quick little recap of Job. Could I get a couple more volunteers? You can go again. We got plenty. You've got something. Oh, you're already volunteering?
I got the first one.
Oh, awesome. So let's do Job 9, 32 to 33. Now a New Testament one. 1 Timothy 2:5. Yeah, Kelly. And then let's go to Job 16, 19 to 21. Josh has got that. And then Hebrews 7, 25. Yep. And Job 19, 25 to 27. Dave French got that one. And 1 Corinthians 15, 20 to 22. You got that? Great. Rebecca's got that one. Okay. Let's go back to Job 9. Actually, before we read this, I just want to say I forgot that Gina and Kelly were going to be here. There's a little bit of plagiarism going on. We both went and we had seen a guest speaker come and speak at Faith Baptist Church, had a guest speaker that had come, and he had talked a little bit about Job. Some of this might be familiar, so I just wanted to give that as a caveat there. Job 9, 32 to 33. Hard language a little bit there. Can we try to glean there? Let me just focus in on, there's no daysman betwixt us is the phrase that I kind of want us to key in there. Anything that tells us something about Jesus based on this lament that I don't have a person that comes between God and myself. I'm kind of throwing it off. You can just say.
Isn't it like Jesus is the enemy? Is God come to us?
Yeah.
But you don't need another man besides Jesus to get to God.
That's right. That's right. And that is the main thrust of it, is that he is definitely setting the stage, saying this. He said, I've got a problem. I've got a problem. There is no way for me to get directly to God. There isn't. I have this gulf in between God and myself. And if only there was someone who could bridge that gap, who could bridge that gap. And it's a perfect foreshadowing of Jesus. So I wrote down in my notes that Jesus is our mediator. Jesus is our mediator. And who had 1 Timothy 2:5?
For there is one God and one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus.
And there we are. There we go. And let's look at Job 16, 19 to 21. Who's got that one? Is that the end of that? Sorry, yes. Okay, great. So again, that the begging is that there would be someone who could plead for me, who could make my case, who could come to God on my behalf. And so I wrote in my notes that Jesus is our intercessor. Jesus is our intercessor. And who's got Hebrews 7:25? Okay.
Wherefore he's able also to save them to the uttermost that come unto God by him, seeing he ever liveth to make intercession for them.
So again, that Jesus is our intercessor. Jesus is our intercessor. And we'll keep moving. Job 19:25-27. Can you read just the first part of 25 again? I was messing with my microphone.
Do I know that my Redeemer lives?
That's the one. So what is it that that we hear from this about Jesus? What do we hear about Jesus? That he is our Redeemer. Jesus is our Redeemer. And Rebecca, can you take us to 1 Corinthians 15:20-22? So Jesus will redeem us, yes. Okay, so that's my quick summary of just a couple of things in Job. Okay, we've got 10 minutes, and we're right on track. We're following exactly to where we need to be. So then we're going to step back out of Job and back into Genesis, picking up around Genesis 12. And Genesis has 50 chapters in it, so we're going from 12 to 50. And just a reminder, what happens after Genesis 11? We've got the Tower of Babel. Everyone's spreading out. Then, huge event, we've got Abraham coming in. Then Abraham has Isaac. Isaac has Jacob. Jacob has Joseph. And Joseph's the one with the coat of many colors who gets sold into slavery into Egypt. And then ends up becoming the second in command over that whole area. So that's what's happening in the second half of Genesis. One thing to notice, too, I think it's fascinating when the Bible does this. When I came up and preached last time, I love to see how the Bible is slowing down. When the Bible starts spending a lot of time on something, it means that, okay, we're starting to hit the brakes because we want to really start to see here's where a lot of the action is happening. And so would we say that the event of the flood was absolutely massive, right? It was literally world-changing in every way, the flood. There are four chapters in Genesis talking about the flood. Big event, big, huge thing that's happening here. By the time that we get to Joseph, now we have 13 chapters, and they're all longer than the chapters that were earlier in the book. So you can just tell as you're reading, if you're doing your study and you're trying to either read through a book of the Bible or whatever, I like to pay attention to just where are we slowing down? Because the places that we're covering a lot of ground fast is where they're written and that we need to study them. But sometimes the Bible is intentionally slowing down for us to try to ask us to start to pay closer attention. For Moses, who is the writer of this, we're getting right up to his great-grandparents, and this story is probably even more fresh. Moses is in Egypt, and we've got a big, long story about how did this happen? How did we get here? How did we get enslaved? There was a lot of good things that happened to get here, but people are still talking about it, right? And so Moses, with God speaking through him as he's writing, but Moses had a lot of this information probably at his fingertips as we're getting closer to the story of Joseph. So let's get a couple more volunteers. Genesis 12:3, Ethan. And let's see, Galatians 3:8-16, Gina. We'll go to Genesis 14:18. Yep, Justin. And who wants my messy Hebrews one? Jen wants it? Jen, you got that. Hebrews 7, a lot of other numbers there. And then Genesis 22:8-13. Anyone scratching their nose? Josh will do it. That's a long one too. Thank you. Romans 5:8. Ooh, a lot of you know it by memory. We'll go with Dave Bird. I have no idea what that is. Genesis 28:12. Yes, yeah, Seth. And then John 1:51. Bruce? Genesis 37:28. Yes, Kelly. And Matthew 26:15. Nikki. Okay, let's jump back to Genesis 12:3. Okay, so here we are. This is the promise to Abraham. He is saying that through your seed, all the people of the world will be blessed. And so Jesus, and this is what I'm saying, we will learn from it. Jesus is the seed who will bless. And let's hear how that's explained in Galatians 3:8-16. So this is one of those examples where a passage in the New Testament is very clearly saying, this was what was told to you, is that there was going to be a seed. And then some people took that to mean, oh, well, you know, seed is just what you throw, and it's a lot of, you know, this is a bag of seed, you know. And it says, no, I was being very specific. When I said seed, I meant one seed. One person. And in Galatians, it helps us understand that one person was Jesus. It wasn't just, oh, it's just all of the people who are just going to be born from your family and you're going to have this great big thing. Even though the English seems to tell us that, yeah, that's a reasonable interpretation. But I think when you get right down to it, as we see Paul telling us in Galatians, he says, no, that was super specific. Out of all of that seed, there was one seed, and that is Jesus. Jesus is the one, is the seed who will bless. Let's keep moving to Genesis 14:18.
And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God.
Okay. And Jen, I'm going to just give you a pass on this one, because unless you want to read it, you definitely can. No, because So this Melchizedek is a really tricky one, right? There's a lot going on with Melchizedek. Melchizedek was somebody who didn't have any specific origin that we know of, did not have a family line that was appropriate for being kind of like a priest, and it explains it in Hebrews. So make sure you go and look that up. All of Hebrews 1 through 17, if we could spend the whole time looking at that. But one of the biggest criticisms of Jesus as priest was that the people of that time said, the priests are supposed to be from Levi. That's what it says. Anyway, you can't have a priest from the line of Judah. That doesn't make any sense. So, therefore, we're not going to believe it. We're not going to believe it because Jesus was not from the priestly line of Levi. And this is the rebuttal. This is the rebuttal that comes out and he goes, was Melchizedek from the line of Levi? We don't know anything about him, do we? So it is possible to have a priest that didn't necessarily come through that Levitical line. Just the fact that there is that argument, to me, is people saying, I don't believe it. I don't believe it. I believe all the facts. I believe all the facts that the Bible tells us, all the biblical account. I believe all that stuff, except for this one thing, that he wasn't of Levi. And then I believe that Paul is the author of Hebrews. You don't have to agree with me. But Paul comes back and says, you know what? There are examples of priests that are not necessarily from Levi, and just shuts down that whole argument. And so, anyway, what we see here in this, and I thought this was fun as I was reading. You can tell it's the only part I'm excited about for some reason. But Jesus is a priest as Melchizedek was. He was a priest as well. Let's move on. Genesis 22, 8 to 13. Josh, you got this one? Or Corinne's got it? Awesome. Thank you, Corinne. Thank you. So this is the story. Abraham, Isaac. Abraham is instructed to sacrifice his son, Isaac. Isaac asks him early on in the story, he says, we don't have anything to sacrifice. Abraham says, God will provide himself something to sacrifice here. And then they get up. Abraham's willing to do it. He's willing to obey to this terrible, terrible request. He's willing to obey. God stops him and says, you know what? I am providing a substitute. Death does need to happen, and I am going to provide a substitute to rescue him. So here I have, in Romans 5:8, I think we know this one, whoever has it. God commendeth his love toward us. Is that the one?
God commendeth his love toward us, and that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us.
Yes, so Jesus sacrifices our substitute, again, reminding us that we deserve to be sacrificed. Jesus is sacrificed on our behalf, as we talked a lot about this morning in the service. Let's get through these last two, and then I'm going to let you go. Genesis 28:12.
And he dreamed, and behold, a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven, and behold, the angels of God ascending.
Okay, this is talking about Jacob's ladder. When Jacob was dreaming, he saw this big staircase or ladder. Let's just read John 1:51. Who's got that one?
And he saith unto him, Verily, verily, I say unto you, hereafter ye shall see heaven open, the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man.
Yeah, and so this is, I was kind of questioning this one when I first came across it, but it's saying that Jacob's ladder is a picture of Jesus who is bridging the gap between heaven and earth. So Jesus bridges heaven and earth is what I have there. Then our last one, Genesis 37:28.
Then there passed by Midianites, merchant men, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. And they brought Joseph into Egypt.
So Joseph had a very close family relationship, close people, people who were close to him, sold him for a handful of pieces of silver. Matthew 26:15, who's got that?
And he said unto them, What will ye give me? And I will deliver him unto you. And they covenanted with him for 30 pieces of silver.
And so that's Judas doing the same thing. Somebody very close to Christ who is betraying him for a handful of pieces of silver. Okay, you're 2 minutes late. I'll do better next time. Would anyone be willing to just close us in prayer? Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
Heavenly Father, thank you for being here tonight, Lord, to study your word and worship you, Lord, to glorify you, Lord. Thank you for being with Dave Lord, Houston, as a pastor, with the prayer in Jesus' precious name.
Amen. Amen. Thank you, everyone.